I'd like now to introduce the next speaker this morning, Professor Tzvi Piran, a colleague whose office is across the corridor from my own one, and therefore I had an opportunity to observe him, not only his physical presence, since I am a little older than Tzvi, also his rise to fame in physics. Tzvi Piran has been working on a number of frontier problems in cosmology, general relativity. Recently, he gained international recognition as one of the leaders and pioneers of the study of the phenomenon of gamma ray bursts. And today he will speak on black holes, the ultimate outcome of Einstein's legacy. Tzvi.
Thank you. Thank you, Hanoch. I would like to talk about black holes, which are not only the ultimate products of Einstein relativity, but also one of the strangest objects that we have encountered in our studies of the universe. The story of black holes begins around 200 years ago with John Michel in England and Pierre-Simon Laplace in France. And both of them reached the conclusions that some of the largest objects in the universe, the largest stars, would be black. And Laplace called this object Astre Noir, or a black star. In order to understand the ideas that led Laplace and Michel to this concept, let's just try a very simple experiment. We take a small ball and throw it up in the air, and we all know that the ball will fall down. We can throw it faster, it will get higher, but it will still get down. But if you take a rocket, it will disappear. It can escape from Earth, and the division is based on the very simple concept, which is the escape velocity. If we send the rocket fast enough, it will be able to get away from the gravity of Earth and go to space, and the escape velocity from Earth is about 8 miles per second, which is fairly large for daily standard, but we can achieve it. Now, both Michel and Laplace have the following idea. Suppose that we have a very massive object with very, very strong gravity. Such object could be so powerful, the gravity could be so powerful, that if we send a flash of light, the light will be attracted by the gravity and will not be able to escape. And for this, of course, the escape velocity from this huge object should be larger than the speed of light, which is enormous, 300,000 kilometers per second, or about 180,000 miles per second. But if the gravity is powerful enough, it can overcome this huge velocity and light will not escape. And if light does not escape, then we have a black star. We have something which we cannot see because light cannot escape from it. Now, Laplace tried to estimate what are the features of such black stars, and he found very strange objects. If we have a black star with the mass of the sun, then it must be very, very dense. It should be condensed to a mere 2 miles, something really very small, much smaller than the size of Los Angeles, but containing as much mass as the whole sun. An alternative will be to consider a huge star as large as the radius of the sun around the Earth. And if we take such a huge star and put inside about billion solar masses, billions times the mass of the sun, we could also get a dark object. These are two different ways to get dark objects, and both of them are very, very different from what at least 200 years ago we thought could exist. So there was a puzzle. Can such objects exist? But there is also a theoretical assumption which was really not verified, and the assumption was the assumption that gravity really attracts light. At that time, there was not the slightest experimental clue to this fact that light is really attracted by gravity. And for both reasons, since there was no conclusive answer to both questions, Laplace abandoned the idea, and he actually felt so bad about it that he actually deleted it from later editions of its book. It appears only in the first edition. If you buy the second edition, it's very expensive by now, you won't find it. The idea came back to life in 1915. And this is, at this year, Einstein formulated the general theory of relativity. And one of the first principles of this theory is, yes, gravity attracts light. And if gravity attracts light, the road to black holes is open. So this is visualization of the idea. If we don't have gravity, light goes in straight light, in straight lines. If we add gravity, then light is curved. So this is the idea, and can it be tested? If we look at the star from very far away, we know that the light comes in a straight light. But then we can have a situation where the sun is very close to the trajectory of the light from the star. And in this case, the light will be attracted by gravity, and it will travel on a curved trajectory. To us, it will look that the star is coming in a different direction, because we will think that the light is coming in a straight line. So this is the idea how to check this possibility. But if you contemplate about this idea for a second, you will realize it's a very silly idea. Because if you look in the direction of the sun, we don't see stars. This is what we see if you look in the direction of the sun. So how can we explore it? And Eddington has the bright idea. Sometimes the moon comes and stands between us and the sun, and we don't see the sun, and then we can see stars in the vicinity of the sun, because the moon will be blocking the light of the sun, and this happens, of course, during a solar eclipse. And during such an eclipse, we will expect that stars in the vicinity of the sun will move from their regular position to some slightly shifted position. And Eddington really set up such an expedition in 1919. This is a picture of this expedition getting prepared to the eclipse. And this is, And this is what they found. They actually found that the star has moved. They measure the motion of the star, the movement of the star, and it was exactly as predicted by Einstein relativity. So this discovery in 1919 actually led to a worldwide appreciation of Einstein. In fact, this was really what brought Einstein to the general public, that made it so famous at that time to the general public. Before that, he was well known just among scientists. Now, today, we have fantastic confirmation of this idea by this concept which is called gravitational lenses and Einstein rings. We see here light from very distant galaxies which is coming to us, and this light is passing in the field of a massive cluster of galaxies, and this massive cluster of galaxies distort the light that comes from distant galaxies, and you see these patches here and here and here. These are all signs not of galaxies that are in these places, but of distorted light which was shifted from its own original trajectory by the gravity of the cluster here. So we know now for sure that this effect happens. And if this effect happens, then we should try to see whether black holes exist. Now, in 1915, just 2 or 3 months after Einstein's formulations of the basic equations of the general theory of relativity, Karl Schwarzschild derived the first mathematical solution for these equations. And this was just a mathematical solution. It was not understood. He did not fully understand what he did at the time, but he obtained the solution. And this solution was very strange. The solution contained the first black hole. To understand what the solution means, let's go back to Einstein's relativity. And the Einstein theory of relativity was a new theory. It changed the rules of the game. But it did not only change the rules of the game, it also distorted the chessboard. Einstein told us that gravity distorts space and time. So it's not only the rules changed, but the game board was changed, and space is not flat anymore. Space is curved, and space is changing. And it happens when gravity is so powerful to overcome all other forces that the distortion of space is so strong that gravity tears a hole in space-time, something which can be visualized in this way. Now, the original solution of Schwarzschild was discovered in 1915, but it took scientists a very, very long time to understand its full meaning. One of the critical contributions was by Albert Einstein and Nathan Rosen in 1935, when they described the concept, which is called now an Einstein-Rosen bridge. And what they have shown is that black holes contain in them some bridge connecting between two different parts of space-time. And this is the boundary of the black hole between them. Now, this was discovered, as I said, in 1935. And the meaning of this bridge was, it took about another 30 years until what it means. And I'll get back to it in a few minutes. Now, to see what's happening in a black hole, we should go back to this experiment with light. And suppose that we are just standing just next to a black hole, and we send a flash of light, the light can escape to infinity. We can also beam the light towards the black hole. This light will be absorbed by the black hole. But let's move for a second into the black hole, and then try to send a flashlight and to use a flashlight and send a beam of light out of the black hole. We'll discover to our surprise that the light, instead of going outwards, as is expected, will turn back and go inwards. Even so, we are trying to send it outwards. And this means that light cannot escape from anywhere inside the black hole, and therefore the black hole is black. And the boundary that surrounds the black hole is called the horizon, because we that stand outside cannot see what is inside the black hole, because no light can come from this from inside. But now something else can be added to this. If you have a very powerful rocket, very powerful spaceship, and we are near a black hole, we can switch on the engine and escape. But if we are inside the black hole, once we moved into the horizon, no matter how powerful are our engines, we can switch them on, we will still be dragged into the center of the black hole and we will be pulled inwards. Inside the black hole, you cannot move outwards. And this means that this horizon, the surface of the black hole, is actually a one-way membrane. You can go in, but you cannot go out. And this is why it is called a black hole. We can fall into it from the outside, but we cannot escape. So this is why the name black hole. It is black because we cannot see it, and it's hole because we can fall into it, but we cannot get out of it. Now, to understand more deeply what's happening here, we have to go to a concept which comes from Einstein's relativity, which he formulated in 1905. And if we take an event in space-time, like this moment here and now, then this event has passed. This is all the events which have influenced us. And it has future. It's all the events that will be influenced by this moment here. But there are other events which are here or there, which are neither influenced by us nor influence us, simply because they are too far, and it will take. They are not connected, causally connected with us in the sense that no information from them to us could have reached, or from us to them could have escaped. So, for example, we all know that it takes about 8 minutes for information to get from the sun to here. So if something happened to the sun right at this very moment and the sun disappeared, it will take us, this is an event which does not influence us right now, we'll know about it only 8 minutes from now. So from this point of view, if something happened to the sun here, it is disconnected from us, it's not causally connected from us, it's in the future, in 8 minutes, so only in 8 minutes from now, we'll know about it. And so this is our future, and as we all know, time goes on. Time goes only forward. So our direction in space and time must, in this diagram, be only forward, only upwards. It can be tilted because we can, if it's completely vertical, if we are standing still, it can be tilted sideways if we are moving. It will be tilted in another direction if we are moving in another direction. And it will be all on this boundary if we are moving at the speed of light. But it cannot be, we cannot move sideways. And now, what happens when we get into a black hole is that inside the black hole, our future cone, we call this in the scientific language, our future cone is directed completely inwards. And since we must move inside this future cone, once we are inside the black hole, we must move inwards. So this is how strange things are. Now, in the 1960s and 70s, something else was discovered, and this was by Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking. The discovery was that inside every black hole, there is a singularity. And this singularity is a point of space and time in which the density is infinite. And in fact, it's one of the biggest puzzles of theoretical physics today, what is happening inside singularities. And it's most likely that only string theory can resolve this feature. So this is a singularity which is sitting inside a black hole. Another thing which is connected with the Einstein-Rosen bridge is the following. This bridge looks as if it's connecting two regions of space-time, two different regions of space. Now, if you take the simple picture of the Schwarzschild black hole, then these two regions are not connected and this bridge is fictitious. But if you take a slightly more complicated solutions, which are correspond either to rotating or to charged black hole, then you can actually try to use this bridge and go from one universe to another in something like this. Now, this idea of space-time travel through black hole have been used quite extensively not far from here, just across the 405 in the various branches of the movie industry. And quite often when you go to some part of a science fiction movie, then you see a black hole and time warp and it goes through it. So this is one possible application of this black holes. However, it doesn't seem to be so simple. In some recent studies which have been carried out, you expect to find yourself in the following situation. You try to go through this bridge, and you find that you're stuck. A singularity has formed just because of the fact that you're trying to pass there. This passage causes a singularity to form. And maybe you will end up appearing somehow in the other side of this, but not in the way that you went in. So don't try to do it, even if somebody is trying to tempt you. Now, these objects are very bizarre. these objects are very strange. Do we have such an object in the universe? Do we have black holes in our universe? And here comes the latest, the last surprise. Black holes are black. Black holes are unseen. You're not supposed to see them. However, it so turns out that the black holes are located within the most powerful and most brightest object that exists in the universe. So this is a paradox, and let me try to say a few words and explain it. It is true, we don't see the black holes. We cannot see the black hole. But black hole is an enormous gravitational force. The black hole is an enormous attracting force. And therefore, a black hole will attract gas and other material from its surrounding. And it will attract this gas and material, and this is an artist's picture, an artist's concept of how this will happen. It attracts this material, and this material forms a spheral pool around the black hole, something which we call an accretion disk. Now, as the matter is going down into this accretion disk and it is channeled into the black hole, it's getting denser and denser. And when something is getting denser, it's getting hotter. So this accretion disk, these accretion disks are extremely hot and are, in effect, the best powerhouses that exist in the universe. Some of these accretion disks emit in X-ray. Others emit in optical radiation and infrared. And we see them in various forms. One form is, and this is the first black hole which have been identified in an astronomical object, the black hole in Cygnus X1. Here we have a star and a black hole which is very nearby to it. This black hole is attracting tearing mass from the star, forming an accretion disk around it. This is actually a picture of the companion, not of the black hole itself. The accretion disk is not seen in visible light, but the accretion disk is emitting X-rays. And these X-rays cannot be seen directly because they are absorbed by the atmosphere. But a satellite, the Uhuru satellite, which was sent in 1973, and this is actually a picture of the satellite and Riccardo Giacconi, who built it, have detected the X-ray light coming from this black hole. And so this is one group, a representative of one group of black holes that we know about. These are black holes of few solar masses. They are not very large in terms of their mass. They include about, this guy in particular has about 10 times the mass of the sun, but the size of this object, the size of this black hole, which has 10 times the mass of the sun, is about 30 kilometers, smaller than the size of Los Angeles. So this is one group of black holes that we know about. The other group that we know about is of even larger and brighter black holes, and these are giant black holes, just like those that Laplace thought about, black holes with about billion solar masses, and they sit not just somewhere, they sit in centers of galaxies. These are pictures of some galaxies. Each galaxy contains about 100 billion stars, and such galaxies are the building block of our universe. Now, in some of these galaxies, maybe in all of them, at the center of these galaxies, there are giant black holes. And we see the emission of these giant black holes in what is known as quasars or blazars. And this emission, in particular in this case, what we see here is, again, an X-ray photograph of the center of this galaxy. And this X-ray photograph shows this very bright object here. And this bright object here is an accretion disk, which is being powered by accretion onto a black hole, into a giant black hole, which sits in the center of our galaxy, of this galaxy. And now what about our galaxy? Our galaxy is the Milky Way. We cannot see it from the outside, but if you look at the dark night, you'll see this patch of stream of stars on the sky, and this is our Milky Way. And this is sort of an artist's concept of how this would look from the outside. But of course, this is a trip that we didn't take yet to go out of our own galaxy. And here at the center of the galaxy, at the center of the Milky Way, there is also a black hole. This is a picture of the center of the galaxy. We don't see the black hole directly. It does not emit optical light. And this particular one does not even emit X-ray because it is a starved black hole. There is no source of matter around it. And with no source of matter around it, there is nothing that can form an accretion disk. So there is no accretion disk, and we don't see the X-ray emission. So how do we know that there is a black hole here? We have been tracking the motion of stars around this black hole for the last 10 years. And from analysis of this motion of the stars around the black hole, we can identify both the location and the mass of the black hole, and we conclude that there is a black hole of about 3 million solar masses locating at this point in the center of our galaxy. So let me conclude and say that Einstein's theory of relativity predicts the existence of black holes, regions in space-time from which nothing can escape, not even light. Black holes form when gravity overpowers all other forces. And after years of hunt, astronomers have identified dozens of small solar mass black holes in our galaxy and other black holes containing millions or even billions of solar masses exist in the center of other galaxies. Thank you.
Our next speaker, Professor Edward Wright from the University of California, Los Angeles, has been working and has significantly contributed to the study of this exciting field. It's my pleasure to invite Ned Wright.
Okay, well, I'm going to be talking about cosmology and, some sense, the history of cosmology, because almost all of what we know about cosmology has, in fact, been developed in the last century. So, of course, in the very old ideas of cosmology, the universe was very small. It consisted only of the solar system, and outside there should be some sort of celestial mechanism that drives the solar system. But today, we have developed a science of cosmology that involves a large amount of observations. And so we have to admit right off the bat that cosmology is an observational science. It's not an experimental science. So we can't do experiments on the universe, at least not easily repeatable experiments on the universe. We can't change the initial conditions and then try it again and see what happens. These are not possibilities. But we can observe what the universe is like, and we can try to insist that the conditions that we see in the universe are compatible with our observations and the same laws of physics that we see in the laboratory. So we want to have the same laws of physics out in the universe at large as what we have on the Earth here. And so that's a very strong universal principle. So if we're not to have any special laws for the heavens, here I've rotated the picture to put the sky on top, then the laws of physics or chemistry that apply on the Earth down here should also apply in the heavens. So we shouldn't really have a separate fifth essence or quintessence to go along with the four elements of ancient chemistry. So let's go back and then start to think about what we actually knew about the universe in 1917 when Einstein came up with his cosmological model. It was one of his first calculations based on the theory of general relativity. And really there was only one fact that was known and was true, which is the sky is dark at night. And so this is actually a rather unusual circumstance, because if you take the simplest possible assumptions about the universe, which would be that it's the same everywhere, homogeneous, and everlasting, static and everlasting, then your line of sight going out from your eye to any part of the sky would eventually hit a star. And having hit a star, then that piece of sky would be as bright as the surface of a star. So we're not talking in terms of this Olber's paradox, it's called. It's not saying that because of this paradox, the sky should be as bright as the daytime sky at night. It's saying that the sky should be as bright as the surface of the sun. So it's not like seeing the daytime sky, it's like staring at the surface of the sun. So we would be cooked. So this is obviously not the case. The sky is dark at night. So, with that one fact in mind, Einstein was ready to try to develop a theory of the universe. And one of the major advances, of course, is general relativity. And general relativity permitted a consistent calculation of the effects of gravity in a homogeneous, uniform universe. And so people, you know, could make some approximations or some assumptions about what would happen in Newton's theory of gravity. And in fact, you can do almost all the calculations that you want to do in cosmology using a Newtonian approximation. But in order to justify that, you really need general relativity. And so Einstein thought that the universe was static. I mean, that's the false fact that Einstein was using. And a static uniform distribution of galaxies is going to be unstable to forming clumps. And so Einstein was motivated, and this is a statement that he makes in his 1917 paper about cosmology, he was motivated to try to form a shorter range theory of gravity. So he wanted to reduce the range of gravity, which we nominally call infinite, even though it's a 1 over r squared force. So we refer to that as an infinite range. He wanted to make it a shorter range force so that the universe as a whole wouldn't be so unstable to form in clumps. And so he added a new constant to his equations. He found he could add a new constant to the equations of general relativity, and he called it lambda. And so I've tried to make the Greek lambda always purple in my slides. And then he went to see what happened. But he found that the effect of lambda added into his theory of general relativity was not what he was looking for. It was different. So what he was trying to do was shorten the range of gravity. So Newtonian gravity, if you have a big star, there's a large gravitational acceleration towards it, but it falls off quickly, 1 over r squared, as you go off and get further and further away. That's what Newton did in unifying the force of gravity on the Earth and the force of gravity that works in the solar system and pulls the moon around the Earth. And if you have a smaller star, then you have a smaller force, but it still falls off 1 over r squared. And Einstein wanted to make a shorter range version of gravity. This is what he said. So he wanted to make the force of gravity smaller at large distance, but still proportional to the mass of the central object. But what he found instead was that by putting in lambda, he developed a repulsive force that acted at large distance. And so this repulsion actually didn't depend on the mass of the central source, so it was more of just a function of space-time or, you know, the universe as a whole. I mean, it's a constant. You know, it depends. It's lambda, the cosmological constant. So Einstein found rather different behavior than what he expected, but that was okay. And so then he went on to construct a static model of the universe. Now, in our modern point of view with quantum mechanics, we consider that the cosmological constant is equivalent to a vacuum energy density that could be formed by quantum fluctuations that occur throughout space-time. So, of course, this is not a string theory picture, but a quantum field theory picture of forming particle-antiparticle pairs out of nothing. You know, time is an axis running up and space is running across, and then annihilating again. And quantum field theory says that if you have the possibility of particles, then you're going to have these particles existing temporarily in the vacuum. And then it actually becomes quite difficult to calculate an energy density for the vacuum that's not infinite. So that's the ultraviolet divergence that we heard about. So there was a big mystery of why the cosmological constant, or the vacuum energy density, was zero. We thought it was zero. And, you know, certainly it was possible that it was non-zero, and then there'd be a cosmological constant. And so what Einstein did was take this long-range repulsion. Now, what I've done here is try to represent the force by a slope. You know, you can imagine having a ball that's rolling down a hill, and that represents a force. And so as you get out to the long-range repulsion, the slope is going to make the size of the universe get bigger, and the slope will get larger as we go out to long range. But then there's a short-range attraction due to gravity. And so if the universe comes over this side, then it will collapse. So you can imagine this as potential energy. And here we have the matter-dominated region, and here's the lambda-dominated region. And the total energy of the universe is here. So if the universe were sitting at the top of the hill, it could, in principle, just sit there. And that's Einstein's theory of gravity, theory of the universe. And so it's, you know, it's a model, but, you know, really, there's a problem with this. Okay, so this model is only metastable. You know, it's obvious. If you have a ball sitting on the top of a hill, it's going to tend to fall off to one side or another. So it's only metastable, and it would either collapse or expand forever. Now, other cosmologists, early workers in the theory of general relativity, and Willem de Sitter was one of the earliest, he published another cosmological model also in 1917. So it was a very early cosmological model. And he took a different approach than Einstein. He said, well, what happens if we only consider lambda? So he had a model which only included lambda, so no matter. And then he found that in this model, there was an increasing redshift with distance. And as has been mentioned before, the first workers often didn't quite understand what was going on. But nowadays, we consider the De Sitter space to have an exponentially accelerating expansion. And so this is one model of, cosmological model that actually is consistent with some of our observations. And then Friedman considered models that only had matter that would expand from a singularity of infinite density. They could stop and recollapse, or they could keep expanding forever. So this is just an illustration of what happens to Einstein's static universe. You know, if it's slightly on the small side of the hill, it'll fall off like that. And if it's slightly on the too large side of the top of the hill, it's going to fall off and become exponentially expanding. So these, Einstein's model was unstable. Friedman pointed this out to Einstein, and at first he thought that it was stable, but then he figured out, he did figure out that it was unstable. So then that combined with the discovery that the universe actually is not static, and so you have an expanding universe. This was a discovery by Edwin Hubble in 1929. So as you increase the distance of a galaxy, you find recession velocities that increase with distance, then led to the following circumstance. So Hubble found a recession velocity proportional to distance. The Einstein static model fails this observational test. So it did not have a redshift. De Sitter model and Friedman models do have a redshift with distance, so they would pass that test. Hubble also studied whether the universe actually is homogeneous and isotropic, the same everywhere, and he decided it pretty much was. We have much better data on that now. And that actually was an observation that fit in with all of the models. Einstein static, De Sitter, and Friedman all passed that observation. So then we can consider whether Einstein's model was consistent with the one fact that actually was known in 1917, and actually there is a problem. So it's static and homogeneous. It's going to fill up with photons from starlight, and eventually the sky will be extremely bright. Now, the expanding models, De Sitter and Friedman, both have a mechanism, the expansion of the universe, that gets rid of this starlight energy, so the sky would remain dark. So both the De Sitter and Friedman models are consistent with Olber's paradox. And so basically, at this point, around 1930, lambda was demoted. So you have expanding models either with or without lambda or with or without matter. But matter is needed because we are here. So the simplest models that worked were the Friedman models without lambda. And so in the computer science term, it was deprecated. It's a feature that, you know, wasn't going to be continued in future models. And here's a book that was published by Donald Goldsmith. This was actually published around 1998. And it's entitled Einstein's Greatest Blunder, The Cosmological Constant and Other Fudge Factors in the Physics of the Universe. So it's actually a good book. You know, Don Goldsmith's a good writer, so if you want to read about this, it's a good place to go. But in sort of a separate track, there was problems in the Friedman model in trying to understand how the universe could get started from this singularity of very high density and then evolve into the circumstance we have now. So if we go back to 1 nanosecond after the Big Bang, the density of the universe was very high. In fact, it was 447 sextillion grams per cubic centimeter. Now, if you were to have the density wrong by just 1 gram per cubic centimeter out of 447 sextillion grams per cubic centimeter, then the universe would have recollapsed now. This is a recollapsing Friedman solution. And so that seemed to be a little bit on the touchy side and hard to arrange. And so there was a problem. And actually, the best solution was one published by Rudyard Kipling in the Just So stories, that it was just so. But then another idea came forward, which comes back to this idea of quantum fluctuations being a possible source of the cosmological constant and the spontaneous breaking of symmetries. So we could have a cosmological constant, a large cosmological constant, early in the history of the universe that would actually disappear as the symmetry was spontaneously broken. And then during this period, when we have the universe expanding with these quantum fluctuations going on, you could actually create perturbations in the universe so it would expand and grow to be larger than the observable universe. This expansion, by the way, actually has the property of setting the density exactly right. So by letting the universe expand by a large factor during this, what's called the inflationary epoch, you could solve these just-so stories that existed in the Friedman universe. But then the idea was that the spontaneous symmetry breaking would occur, the vacuum energy density would entirely go away. Now, this pattern that we set up by having the quantum fluctuations growing all the time actually produces a pattern on the cosmic microwave background sky that's called equal power on all scales. And the COBE data actually, when COBE was a satellite launched in 1989, actually observed the sky. You can see the statistical properties of the sky away from the galactic plane, the Milky Way, this is local interference, do look like equal power on all skies. And so this actually was then described by Stephen Hawking as the discovery of the century, if not of all time. But I'd like to be a little more modest and, you know, point out that one century ago, we knew almost nothing about the universe. So we've discovered a lot about the universe. And then the next big discovery actually brought lambda back to life now. And this is the discovery of the accelerating universe. Distant supernovae are fainter than expected. That was the observation. And it was a big surprise, and it was Science Magazine's breakthrough of the year. And remember that lambda causes acceleration. Acceleration causes faintness. So what are supernovae? Well, supernovae are stars. Here's a star before, and here's the star after. These are stars that blow up, destroy themselves, and become as bright as the entire galaxy in which they reside. And therefore, we can see these stars over an incredibly long distance in the universe. And recently, it's all in the last decade or so, we've learned how to read the power label on these light bulbs. And so if you look at this light bulb, you can see it's 40 watts. And so we've now learned how to read the equivalent of that label on supernovae. And so we can actually tell by how bright they appear and knowing how luminous they really are, we can figure out how far away they are. So now in terms of what Hubble found with velocity increasing proportional to distance, this is Hubble's original data in the 1929 paper. And with the supernovae results in 1995, just after we'd learned how to read the label, Hubble's data fits down here, and now we have an incredibly good fit to a straight line. So this is data from Ries, Press, Kirshner, 1995. So it's very good data. But now, with the Hubble Space Telescope and other large telescopes, we've managed to go further, and we actually now, in 2004, have data like this. So here are the supernovae data now. You'll notice the velocities get larger than the velocity of light. The velocity here is just quoted as the speed of light times what's called the redshift. And the distances get very, very large. These are very distant supernovae. And if the universe, well, this would be, you know, sort of the Hubble law, naively. This is the simplest Friedman model, which is the Einstein de Sitter model. And you can see all the points lie at greater distance for a given velocity. And that means the supernovae are fainter than expected because they're further away. De Sitter's model, which is expanding exponentially, accelerating all the time, is too faint, and we're in between. So we have a model now where the universe was decelerating in expansion, and now it's accelerating in expansion, so it's in between. And this is the standard model today. So now we have a conundrum. We had a large cosmological constant during inflation, and it went away. And now we seem to have a small cosmological constant. And so there's a big question. You know, is it going to go away again? Is it going to get stronger? Is it the same now as it was 5 billion years ago? So these are all questions that could be addressed by observation. And the Department of Energy and NASA want to join together to produce a spacecraft called the Joint Dark Energy Mission, a truly inspirationless name. And I'm on the JDEM science definition team, so we're meeting occasionally to think about concepts. And this is one of the concepts. I just want to point out, NASA needs money. So write your congressman. Write your president. We need more money to do the exciting things we can do. So now let's get back to what I started with, which is whether we actually have the same laws of physics in the laboratory and in the universe as a whole. And here we're kind of weak, because the cosmological constant, while it no doubt exists in the laboratory, can't be observed in the laboratory. It has tiny effects in the laboratory. We can't measure it. So what we really want to do is go out in the universe and look to make sure that lambda exists by as many means as we can. And so there are several independent methods that all agree on the existence of lambda. I'll just talk about one, which is one that I've worked on. Here's a cosmic microwave background map, now with much better angular resolution, produced by the WMAP satellite. And this is a map of where radio sources are in the sky, produced by the Very Large Array out in New Mexico. And these maps have a weak correlation. This correlation is actually due to a general relativistic effect called the late integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. And so with about 99%+ confidence, we're pretty sure that lambda exists on the basis of this effect. So that's one of the independent ways of checking that lambda exists. And I'm working on another satellite called the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer that should fly in 2008 or maybe 2009 if NASA doesn't get more money. But it hopefully will fly, and we'll actually be able to count galaxies to a great distance out to, you know, 5 to 7 billion light years away. And that would allow us to do a better confirmation of the existence of lambda by virtue of the late integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So let's summarize. Is lambda a blunder or a triumph? So it's certainly part of general relativity. Without general relativity, we would have essentially no consistent way to discuss the gravitational effects in the universe. And it allows a place for lambda, and so it's obviously a good thing to check out the effects of it. But Einstein inserted lambda to explain a fact that, in fact, was false, that the universe was static. But now lambda lives on, you know, with the observations of the accelerating universe. So it looks like a, you know, pretty much a good thing to have done. And so we really need to figure this out to understand inflation in the early universe, high energy particle physics, and also what's going on in the universe now. And so I'll just put up this slide. That's my last slide, so that's it.
And the last speaker of this exciting session is Professor Terry Sejnovsky from the Salk Institute. His training is in physics, but as you look at his bio, you will see that he is adjunct professor in departments of biology, physics, computer science, cognitive science, and there may be a few other disciplines which I left out. And this attests to one of the highlights in Terry's career. Actually, I have known him way back when he was one of the pioneers, of the key players in the emergence of a new discipline, computational neuroscience, which is a paradigmatic change to the study of the brain. And since then, since it started, has gained momentum. And today, in many universities, as like at the University of Jerusalem, there are such centers which combine the methods and concepts of all these disciplines which I have mentioned to study the phenomenon of the brain. Our speaker has been one of the pioneers of this development. So please come to the podium, Terry.
Well, thank you, Hanok, for such a wonderful introduction. And it really is wonderful to be here. The morning talks have really been exciting for me, reconnecting to my background in physics. Now, I've prepared this talk as a bridge between the earlier talks on Einstein's contributions to physics, as a bridge between those talks and the talk we're going to hear after lunch from Harold Varmus. But what I didn't appreciate was that this would also be a bridge from the last talk on black holes. And the reason is that when I first arrived at Princeton in the late 60s, I went to work with John Wheeler. And his bridge between the more mathematical form of relativity, which was prevalent at the time, and the relativistic astrophysics that you saw here was very crucial. It was John who actually coined the term black hole. And his lab meetings were the most exciting intellectually adventure that I could ever have imagined. He was talking not just about black holes, but about wormholes, about gions, and asking questions about what would happen at the Planck length, the quantum foam. I mean, he was really way ahead of his time, because it's only now that physics has really caught up with him. But he gave me a problem to work on. He said, Terry, what would happen if we put a black hole in the middle of a galaxy? And he gave other people's projects, what if we had a micro black hole that was sitting on the table? What would it look like? And so I went off and I did some calculations, and I discovered that because of the tidal forces, it's differential forces that would squeeze matter like a toothpaste tube, and a gas or stars falling into a black hole, as you heard, would produce an enormous amount of energy. You heat the gas up, it would really be a great source of energy. In fact, it might even serve as the source of energy in quasars, which were a great mystery at the time. And so John said, Terry, this is wonderful. You should publish this. So I wrote it up, and I thought that before I submitted it, I should get some advice from distinguished scientists outside of Wheeler's lab. So I asked Lyman Spitzer, a distinguished astrophysicist in a space telescope now named after him, you know, what's your opinion of the paper? He looked, read it, and said, well, you know, Terry, there isn't any evidence for a black hole yet. Do you really want to start your scientific career with a mistake by publishing a paper on something that may not exist? Well, that was discouraging, but I was a theoretical physicist, so intrepid as I was, I went to Freeman Dyson and asked him what he thought of this paper. And he said, Terry, this is obvious. I wouldn't bother publishing this. The biggest mistake in my life was taking their advice. Because if I had taken John Wheeler's gift and just gone ahead and published it, maybe things would be different. It would have changed my life in a way that would have sent it off in a different direction. But that's a prelude to what I want to tell you about, which is the paper on Brownian motion that we've already heard about from Honeck's talk. This is actually self-published. It was published first as a pamphlet and later in a journal. Robert Brown was a Scottish botanist, and he was a very good observer, and he noticed that small pollen grains, when he looked under the microscope, seemed to be jiggling around. And he in this pamphlet, sort of went through a whole set of observations and tried to understand what it could possibly be, suggesting that this might be part of the vital essence of life that he was seeing here, because after all, pollen grains contain the germ of life. So just to illustrate to you what Brownian motion looks like, I have a movie I'm going to show you. This is not pollen grains. It was quickly determined that, in fact, you don't need pollen. You could do this, see the same thing when dust motes are in the water. This is actually an emulsion of fat globules in milk. And these little spheres here, little fat globules, are on the order of a micron in size. And just to give you a sense for the scale, human hair is about 20 to 100 microns in diameter, which would be larger than this entire screen. So this, we're talking here about little spheres that are at the limit of the light microscope. So let's watch in real time the jiggling that Robert Brown first observed. So you can see that they're kind of jiggling in a kind of a funny random way. And it's like they're somehow being energetically boosted. How and why was a very hot topic at the time. Now I want to point out something here that could be you could make an observation you can make on your own. This Yogi Berra once said it's amazing what you can see if you just look. So I don't know if you can see it, but there are different sizes here. Here's a big one that's probably 2 or 3 microns, and there are some smaller ones here that are much smaller, half the size or less. And if you look carefully, you'll see that the smaller ones are jiggling a lot faster than the big one. Now, you'd have to quantify this. You'd have to look at a lot of them and vary it and measure this quantitatively. But that turns out to be true. And also turns out to be a prediction of Einstein's theory. So let me go through the chronology. I think this is a fascinating historical subject. I just want to give you a very brief natural history of Brownian motion, and I'm going to use it to illustrate a couple of general points about science. So first of all, this original paper was published in 1827. It was independently observed by a Frenchman. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, Brogniart. In 1824, unfortunately, he didn't know that it was Brownian motion, otherwise he would be more famous. So a sequence of papers spanning almost 70 years followed, in which one investigator after another followed up some hypothesis. So here's someone who thought perhaps it had to do with light, bombardment of light, and that it was possible to design experiments to rule that out. Well, maybe it's temperature differences. Maybe what you're seeing is heat coming and going inside the fluid. No, you could rule that out too. Well, someone has suggested that perhaps it has something to do with stored energy. So what they did was they sealed these small particles in a container for a year and came back, and they were still jiggling. So that ruled that out. Perhaps it was electricity. Do experiments to rule that out. The first suggestion in the literature as to what would not finally be accepted as the explanation was that perhaps this had to do with the random impact of fluid molecules that was hitting it from many different directions. And then by chance, more would hit it in one direction than the other. And that was about 50 years after the original observation. Now this I find astounding, that it took 50 years to come up with the right explanation. I mean, an observation like that today would have been just pounced on by dozens of scientists, and they would have just beaten it to death in a couple of months. I'm serious. I mean, it's, the timescale of science has changed dramatically. But there weren't that many scientists back then in the 19th century, and certainly not as many that would be interested in following this up. In fact, it wasn't even clear whether this was kind of a sideshow, what this has have to do with big, important issues. Well, the seminal paper in 1905, which, by the way, was not the first, his first in this area. He had a sequence of papers starting in 1902 dealing with the molecular and kinetic theory of gases, and then continuing on after this paper, following up on it. But in this paper, he came up with what we now have as the important equation governing what's called Brownian motion. Now, what's interesting about this paper, and I read it, went back and read it recently, is that he's clearly aware of Brownian motion. He actually quotes it in the first paragraph. However, he quotes it in a funny way. He says that there may be some evidence for this, but it's probably not the same thing. And the reason was that he didn't know the literature. Einstein was not aware of this 50 years, well, in this case, by this time, it's now up to, let's see, that's 80 years. 80 years of research, right? He just didn't know the literature. Now, little did he know that at the same time, independently, several mathematicians were working along similar lines. Again, he wasn't part of the community. He was isolated. There was a mathematician who worked out the first mathematical theory of random walks, and it was done in the context of mosquito infestation, where you're asking how fast is it spread. Von Smoluchowski actually had a very elegant mathematical theory, which came to exactly the same conclusions using a very different mathematical framework. He was had been working on this for 5 years. He did know the literature, and he was obviously it was a long-term research program. But it was really Einstein who appreciated how important this problem was, and the reason is that this was the first and the best evidence for molecules. There were, as Honeck said, there were famous physicists, Mach, Wilhelm Ostwald, who did not believe in the existence of atoms as late as 1905. In fact, and not until much later. In fact, it wasn't until 1921 when Perrin made very definitive measurements, very quantitative measurements, and assembled all the evidence and really convinced everybody that there is no other explanation except molecules bombarding these globules, these microscopic objects you can see in the microscope. It was, in a sense, a bridge between the microscopic world and the macroscopic world, that we can actually see fluctuations. Einstein recognized that understanding fluctuations was really going to be key and important to the future of physics, such as the fluctuation dissipation theorem, which was actually something he was quite well aware of. So here is what's called a random walk. Honeck showed this very same image, and must have gotten it from the same website that I did. So here's a molecule starting out, and this is successive snapshots. At, say, every second, you take a picture and ask, where is the particle? So first it's here, and then it's here, and then it's here, and it's here. And you can see that it's wiggling back and forth. And it's that doesn't seem to be making much progress. Sometimes it goes forward, sometimes it goes backwards. It wanders around, and it ends up here. Can we understand that? And this is what the question that Einstein asked. So here's a little computer experiment. If you just look at one, it looks almost incomprehensible to predict where it's going to go. In fact, if it's really random, you can't. But if you do the experiment 1,000 times, you can get a distribution. You can say, on average, where is it going to be? So in this experiment, 1,000 particles, each one of these is one of these red dots, starts out at the origin, and here's the game. You can take a step in any direction. You pick a direction at random, and you take one step forward, one unit. And then you do that over again. You repeat it over and over again. And if you do that, you get what you can see is a nice cloud that has a certain diameter. And if we plot in the cross-section the number of times it goes a certain distance, the number of particles that have reached a certain distance, you can see that it has a nice smooth peak. And the question is, how far does it go? And there's a theory that tells us how far it goes, in fact, predicts the actual distribution. And that theory tells us that the mean distance, the average distance, is proportional to the square root of the number of steps that you take. Now, that's interesting because if time is measured by the number of steps, this means that it goes as the square root of time. And in fact, in Einstein's paper, what Einstein showed was that this random walk, in fact, can be derived from basic physical principles. And what's under the square root there is a constant called the diffusion constant times time. And that diffusion constant had a couple of terms in it. It's proportional to temperature. That means that the higher the temperature, the farther the particle will go. It was also inversely proportional to the drag. And that means the larger the particle, not going to go as far. So inherent in Einstein's formulation was a terrific way to actually test it, his theory, which was to vary the temperature, vary the viscosity of the fluid, vary the size, and all those experiments were done by Perrin over the next 20 years, just nailing it, just convincing everybody that, in fact, this equation has to be true. Now, there was one other, and Einstein was very actively engaged in that process. He pointed out, for example, that the measurements that the experimentalists had been making up to that point, which was the velocity of the jiggling particle, was the wrong one to make. Because there is actually, as time goes to zero, there's no limit. The velocity is distance over time. And it turns out that it's a fractal geometry. And it wasn't, in fact, until later when Norbert Wiener worked out a full mathematical theory that we realized we needed a whole new calculus to handle situations like that. And he pointed out that the important thing was to measure the distance traveled over a long period of time. Now, that's the background. What I want to do now is show you how this basic concept of a random walk can be used to help us understand basic phenomena in biology. Because you see, if you go down to the dimension of the cell, you're dealing with particles that are of the size, exactly the size that they were seeing under the microscope, and smaller, which means that you're in a regime where buffeting by the random kinetic motion of molecules is really a first-order issue. You really have to live in that regime. But biology, through evolution, doesn't just live with something like diffusion. It actually builds on it. It uses diffusion. And without diffusion, you would die. If I could suddenly turn off Brownian motion in your body and your brain, you would stop thinking, you would stop breathing, everything would come to a grinding halt. And I have a movie I'm going to show you where you can actually see, I'm going to shrink you down to the size of a cell, of a small piece of a cell, so you'll actually get a feeling for what it's like to live at that scale. Now, in the movie, you're going to be seeing what's called the synapse, which is the way that two neurons communicate with each other. Now, the synapses between neurons are thought to be important for, first of all, communicating information, for example, from your sensory receptors in the eye, for example, to the brain. You have to communicate that from one neuron to the next. And nature has created a very elaborate, almost Rube Goldberg way of doing that. And I'm going to show you what it looks like. But I can tell you that it's incredibly important. The reason is that the number of synapses in your brain is one of these astronomical numbers. It's 10 to the 1/5, to the 15th power. You know, there are 10 to the 11th stars in the galaxy. Just to give you a sense for, you know, astronomical numbers. I always thought that was a huge number until I realized that it wouldn't. If I had a dollar for every star in the galaxy, I couldn't cover this year's national budget deficit. But 10 to the 15th truly is astronomical, right? That goes beyond the GNP by a large fraction, by many orders of magnitude. So there's a lot of these. They're repeated. They've got to be important. And the question is, you know, what are they made from? How are they organized? So here's a blow-up. Here's one of these synapses. There's a presynaptic side. This is the side that is going to transmit the information. And here's the postsynaptic side. This is the one that will, this is the side that now is going to receive it. So it's a transmitter on this side, a receiver on this side. And the way that you send the signal is with molecules, neurotransmitter molecules that are released from the presynaptic side and then diffuse over using Brownian motion to the postsynaptic side, where they, in this blow-up here, you can see them diffusing. They're released by I'll mention in a second, by a fusion event. The molecules diffuse over, and they bind to these little proteins called receptors on the postsynaptic side. Now, these are all molecular machines. They've been evolved over, you know, hundreds of millions of years, and they're very efficient. They work at the molecular level. Now, in 1952, Sir Bernard Katz received the Nobel Prize for his fundamental discoveries for how this is done, and it was work that he did at the neuromuscular junction of the frog, and it's a very interesting synapse. You'll see it in a minute, but it turns out that what he found there is true for all synapses, all chemical synapses, and the way that they work is by packing together the neurotransmitter into little spheres called vesicles, and they're very small, 50 nanometers in diameter, contain about 5,000 neurotransmitter molecules, and when they're released all or none as a packet. Most of the time. There is occasionally times when the packet will open and close very rapidly. That's called kiss and run. But but when a full event occurs, you just dump it, and within microseconds, now you have a signal that's in this very brief little cleft here. And now when the molecule binds to the receptor, there are changes that occur in its structure. And here's, for example, at the neuromuscular junction, the name of that receptor is the acetylcholine receptor, and the name of the transmitter is acetylcholine. So here's where acetylcholine binds, and when two of them bind, a little hole forms in the membrane. This lipid bilayer separates the inside and the outside of the cell, and it's impermeable to ions like, for example, sodium and potassium, which are outside and inside. But when that hole opens, that pore opens, it suddenly forms a bridge, and these ions now flow through down the electric force field and also according to the concentration gradient, producing an electrical signal on the postsynaptic side, and then that causes a lot of other things to happen. So we want to understand that process. We want to understand every single step, and we want to be able to incorporate in a very realistic way the actual geometry. So here's a real, everything up to now is a cartoon. This is a real electron microscope picture of a real synapse. This is the neuromuscular junction that Bernard Katz worked on. And I want to point out, again, a couple of things that you can, if you look at this long enough, you'll notice. First of all, you'll see the vesicles up here. These are the ones that contain acetylcholine. And you'll notice that they're gathering around this region here and this region here. That's called the active zone. And it's believed that this is where they fuse with the membrane. So this is the presynaptic terminal. And then the bottom of the slide here is a muscle cell, right? Neuromuscular junction is the synapse between a motor neuron and a muscle. And when that synapse releases transmitter, the muscle contracts. And that's why you're able to move your muscles. Now, you know, we know where the acetylcholine receptors are located. They're located mainly at the top here, where you see this thickening, this black thickening at the top, and to a lesser extent down into these deep folds whose function is not known. There's a lot of detail here that we don't understand, but we do know a lot about what's going on here, right at the active zone. Now, there is one other player you have to know about. There's the acetylcholine, that's the transmitter, and the receptor. But in order to get to the receptor, it has to go through a gauntlet of an enzyme called acetylcholinesterase, which hydrolyzes the acetylcholine, breaks it into two groups that are not active, cannot bind to the receptor. And you need to do that to shut off the reaction. You don't want the muscle to go on twitching forever. You want it to give a very brief twitch and then to stop. And in fact, nerve agents, which are very potent at killing you, act by binding to the esterase and inactivating it, and thereby eliminating the possibility of stopping the reaction, of that the acetylcholine will continue to activate the receptors. Okay, so this is the geometry, and this is what's called neuroanatomy. We have lots of pictures of the brain like this, but they're all static, right? We want to bring them to life. How are we going to do that? And we also need to take into account the time constants, for example, for the diffusion, across that cleft, the binding to the receptor, those have all been measured in great detail. So how are we going to put all those together? So here's, I want to show you a little bit of work that comes from my lab. It's a program that we've developed called MCell, and that stands for Monte Carlo Model for Modeling Cell Signaling. And I'm going to show you a movie which is a simulation of what happens at the neuromuscular junction when a single vesicle of acetylcholine is released into the cleft. Now, the first step is to take this two-dimensional cross-section and take a bunch of serial sections and reconstruct them as a three-dimensional surface, a three-dimensional object, actually, in the computer. This is all going to be done in a computer. So we first get a very accurate three-dimensional reconstruction, and then we use an approach to simulating the release of the transmitter and the diffusion, which is called the Monte Carlo technique, which was invented by physicists who are trying to model very complex physical situations. For example, what happens when a nuclear explosion takes place. I believe it was, in fact, first invented at Los Alamos. Now, the way that you do the simulation is exactly the way I described that first experiment. You have a random number generator, which is giving you random numbers, and using the random number, you decide which way the molecule is going to go. Should it go up or should it go down? How far it should go is also something that you also have to include. Now, it turns out that random numbers are very hard to get in large numbers. In other words, if I gave you a number, say 224, and I asked you, is that random? Who knows? Right? You have to look at the other numbers to see how they're related. Well, okay, let's say the next number is 2. You need to have actually formalize what you mean by random, and that turns out to be non-trivial. Mathematicians actually have developed a very complex theory of what it means to be random. But nature, randomness is free. It's just sitting there. It's all these random bombardments. But we have to actually create our random numbers, and in our program, most of the time is spent generating random numbers. Or actually, they're not really random. They're a pseudo-random because, in fact, they can't possibly be random because we know how we made them, right? And in fact, Saul Galoam, who's in the audience, is one of the people responsible. They're called shift register sequences for creating what's called pseudo-random numbers, and that's what we use. So here's the M-cell simulator. What it does is it keeps track of every single molecule on every time step. At every time step, we look at where the acetylcholine molecules are, and if they're near a receptor, with a certain probability, they bind. And if it binds, if two of them bind, with a certain probability, the receptor opens. We just keep track of every single detail. This is a brute force technique, but it allows us to actually look at the quantitative detail of exactly what effect the geometry has and variations in some of the other parameters. So let me, and I wonder if we could take the lights down a little bit, because this is an interesting movie that would benefit from, you know, as if we were in a real movie theater. Okay, thank you. Okay, so what you're going to see, let me give you a little prologue. What you're going to see is the release of a single vesicle. And you're going to see actually about a microsecond in the life of the synapse when the vesicle, about halfway through the whole process of activating the receptors. So it's just a brief slice. Now we took the simulation and we used a program. This was done by Tom Bartol, who's a staff scientist in my lab, and Joel Stiles, who's at Pittsburgh. They used the same program called RenderMan that's used by Pixar to produce all those wonderful animations. So it really does have a sense of being in a movie. We color-coded all the molecules. I won't go into detail except that when it's open, the acetylcholine receptor turns yellow. And these are the esterases. They also turn colors. But the key thing to keep in mind is that acetylcholine is going to be turquoise. So here's the time course, and here's the slice, the brief third of a microsecond. Here's the geometry. These little white things are the vesicles. And now as we come closer, you're going to see the blue particles that are located on the bottom here. That's the muscle, are the acetylcholine receptors. The little white spheres here. The white spheres here are the esterases. And this gives you an idea of how big it is. I mean, this is actually about 1% of the junction. So we only reconstructed a small part of it. It's a huge synapse. It's a massive synapse. And the reason is it has to be absolutely reliable, because when you send the signal to move the muscle, you better move it. Okay, now we're going to actually fly in. So hold on to your seats. And soon we're going to come to the ground zero. This is where the neurotransmitter had been recently released, and we're going to actually see what Brownian motion looks like inside this neuromuscular junction, and I can assure you that at every millisecond this is happening in your body, in your brain. All of these little jiggling particles here are acetylcholine molecules. Some of them have bound now to these receptors. You see the blue ones are unbound, red is singly bound, and now if you look down, this is looking down, it's like a canyon. And this gives you a sense that we're dealing with a structure here which at this scale looks like a city block. It's not just a simple, small geometric structure. It's really very, very vast. And this is just a single vesicle. These yellow particles here, those are the receptors that are now conducting. This is ground zero. And we look at it from above now, from the nerve terminal down, you can see that this is the vesicle that just recently released its contents. So that gives you a feeling for what it's like to actually live in a synapse. Now we can have the lights back up again. This is a tool that we've created that we can use for studying many other problems. In fact, all of cell biology is based on signaling with molecules like this. Signals between cells and also intracellular signals within cells. Ron Evans, for example, who couldn't be here for personal reasons, was one of the people who discovered what are called nuclear receptors. These are receptors like the acetylcholine receptor that are on the surface of the membrane, and when they're activated, they actually go into the cell and find their way to the nucleus where they activate genes. All of that can be simulated with this very same program if you have enough information about the receptors, the binding constants, and all of the other, the geometry. Now, I told you earlier there are 10 to the 15 synapses. They're not as big as the neuromuscular junction. That's a giant synapse. This is a typical synapse that's found on one of your pyramidal cells in your cortex. And this is the kind that now carries excitatory information. This is the presynaptic side in blue, and the postsynaptic side, if you can see that, which is kind of a reddish color. When this synapse is activated, it only releases one vesicle at a time. And it's probabilistic. In other words, sometimes it doesn't release any vesicles. So this simulating this takes things, it ultra-miniaturizes things down to the level where you're dealing with only a handful of things. This is, instead of a city block like the neuromuscular junction, this is more like a ma-and-pa operation. The number of receptors, there's only a few hundred. When it's activated, the number of ions that goes into that postsynaptic structure is, you can count them on your hands. We're in the process right now of collaborating with other groups at Caltech and elsewhere to actually simulate what's going on inside this synapse. And the reason why we think it's really important to get it right is that we think that all of your experiences, everything you know about your life and about the world, probably is embedded your memories are encoded in the strength of the synapse and the kinetic properties of the synapse. And that's all molecular machinery that we are opening up as I speak. Biologists are opening this up. They know all the proteins now, that we know all the genes, but now the question is how to put that together and understand how this machine works. The other simulations that we're doing are with E. coli. So E. coli is a single cell. It's a bacterium, but it can do some interesting behaviors. For example, it can divide. How does the E. coli know where the midpoint is? That's a non-trivial problem, right? How do you know where your midpoint is from the inside? It swims around. These are flagella. It can chemotaxis. It can actually follow a chemical gradient, something called chemotaxis. How does it do that? We know a lot about that, and we're beginning to know a lot more about the machinery inside of the bacterium that allows that to happen. We can simulate that now. We can understand something about the molecular motor and the mechanisms that activate it and the algorithms that life actually used in order to create behavior, interesting behavior. And that really leaves me now with the last point I want to make, which is that of the three papers, the famous papers in 1905, the Annus Mirabilis, the great impact that the relativity paper and the quantum theory paper had was enormous on the 20th century. It defined science in the 20th century. But now that we've understood much, much more about the origin of life, about DNA, a discovery that was made mid-century by Jim Watson and Francis Crick. Francis was a close colleague of mine at the Salk Institute. It's now clear that we're going to understand over the next century how it is that cells, for example, develop. That's what stem cells are all about, differentiation and development. How do they form the nervous system? Even more impressive than the fact that your brain is so powerful is the fact that it's created by an automatic developmental process that just continues to go on for years and years and years. We're going to understand that. And it's all done at the molecular level with molecular techniques. In order to get and understand them, it's going to be essential to take into account the discovery that Einstein made in his third paper on Brownian motion, because that's really the engine that's driving this. So finally, I wanted to thank the team that actually created M-Cell and continues to work on it. I want to point out in particular that the very concept of using this approach to modeling did not start in my lab. It started in Miriam Salpeter's lab at Cornell. Mika was a neurobiologist who did the pioneering work on quantifying the number of receptors at the neuromuscular junction and the kinetics, for example, of the esterase. And she wanted to know, she had these very, very accurate numbers, how can I match them to the behavior of the synapse? Well, fortunately, she was married to a physicist, Ed Salpeter, a distinguished astrophysicist that some of you probably know. And Ed said, well, you know, I think the right approach to this problem is the Monte Carlo technique. And he worked out some of the basic physics. He showed how you could match the probabilities and the reaction rates in a rigorous mathematical way. And that was applied to the neuromuscular junction in their lab. And when Tom Albright, who was a graduate student, came over to my lab, kind of an intermediate vector boson between the two labs, we continued that on into the central nervous system. And now it's going to be applied not just to the brain, but it's going to be applied to all cells. And in fact, computers are getting faster and faster and memory cheaper and cheaper. So someday, we may actually be able to simulate, for example, all the proteins, all the important molecules in a bacterium. There is about 100 million proteins, single protein molecules in E. coli. And that's now coming within range of what we can do in our computers, especially the modern supercomputers. So thank you all. And I guess we can go on to the next part.